Welcome to On Demand with Jenna Ellis. This is our AFR exclusive podcast where we do a deep dive into the issues and topics that you want to hear about with guests and commentary that you want to hear from. And as always, if you have an idea for a topic that you want to discuss or you would like to learn more about, you can reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net. And we often cover things that listeners write in and ask about. So this is a great opportunity for you to actually get involved. And today we are discussing the idea of parental rights, why they are considered fundamental in the American constitutional tradition, and why they are deeply rooted in the principles of liberty, family autonomy, and the natural rights doctrine that underpin the Constitution. And this is, of course, within the context of the Supreme Court oral arguments in a case that deals with public schools wanting to provide to students without a parental opt-out this content that is LGBTQ focused. And so the argument from the public schools, and by public school, we should always define that as government-funded institutions. These are things that, of course, are run by the state. And while no parent has an obligation to send their children to public schools, this is why school choice is kind of a big deal and why it should be even more emphasized the further and further publicly funded education goes from traditional morality, and when they are providing content that is against the religious views and worldviews of specifically Christians. But in this case, it's actually an Islamic family that doesn't want this type of LGBTQ content. So this is kind of the setup, right, of the Supreme Court saying that parents shouldn't be able to opt out their children from reading about same-sex couples, same-sex marriage, overtly sexual content. And this went all the way up to the Supreme Court this week. And the oral arguments are always fascinating to listen to. I did not get to listen to the entire thing, but I listened to about the first hour and then caught some of the highlights from after this. And the first hour was actually really important, I think, even more than later on into the arguments, because while most people are anticipating that the conservative wing of the court, which doesn't always include Justice Roberts, you know, it's kind of this mixed bag a little bit, but generally speaking, at least the conservative majority of the court is going to side with the parents who sued the school district and say, yes, absolutely, parents can opt out their children of this type of content when it violates their sincerely held religious beliefs. And that's a good thing. But the argument from Justice Sotomayor and also Justice Kagan, Justice Jackson a little bit, I mean, these are the three basically feminist liberals on the court. Their arguments, and specifically Justice Sotomayor, was very fascinating to me as a legal scholar from the perspective of the precedent that she is attempting to establish, which basically we need to go back further than just this case. We need to recognize that what the left has been trying to do for decades is to redefine what it means to be a family, redefine parentage, redefine parental rights, and redefine what it means to even have children. Because we heard for a long time, and listeners will be very familiar with Hillary Clinton, for example, saying, you know, it takes a village, and Joe Biden and Kamala talking about how children belong to all of us, and children are part of the state. And this whole idea that is completely antithetical to the biblical worldview, that children are wards of the state, and basically parents are temporary custodians that have to follow the will of the state, right? That is antithetical to what we read in Scripture. Scripture says that God ordained the family unit, and one man, one woman for life in marriage is the, and one man, one woman is the only biological context in which a child can be conceived and then born to the parents. Children are not born to the state. And so God gives children to parents to raise in the fear and admonition of the Lord and to make the best decisions for their whole family unit and also for their children. And so if parents are acting biblically, they're not going to be perfect, of course, but they are going to make decisions that are in the best interest of their children that may look a little different than other families. And obviously there is an objective metric of biblical parenting. And then there are some things that are wisdom issues. Whether you choose, for example, to homeschool your kids versus send them to a private Christian school, versus some of these other options, that's a wisdom decision. It's not biblically commanded that you must homeschool. Listeners know that I was homeschooled K-12. I think that was one of the greatest blessings that my family ever gave me. But that's not ultimately for every student, every family. And sometimes there can be economic factors, there can be a wide variety of other things that go into it. But the bottom line is that parents always have their children's best interests at heart. I mean, and there are exceptions to that where there is, you know, abuse, for example. Custody can be removed when a parent is shown beyond the legal standard to be unfit. But there is a presumption of fitness for parentage. And the state should be very, very careful at overriding parental rights and that from a fundamental liberty right. It's not just a privilege that because now some parents, for example, to homosexual individuals, right, that because they can adopt children and create a semblance of a family unit that is well outside of natural law and well outside of God's commands, that because of that, somehow now this right that is a fundamental right ordered in natural law, ordained by God, is now merely a privilege because we've attached this whole concept of civil rights, right? So the founders viewed the family as a natural institution and recognized that parents have a primary God-given responsibility to raise and educate their children. So this principle aligns with natural law theory, which was foundational to the Declaration of Independence, later constitutional interpretation. And John Locke, whose writings heavily influenced the founders, and, you know, we can have the whole argument over social contract theory and all of that later, or you can read that in my book, The Legal Basis for a Moral Constitution. But he argued, Locke, that parental authority comes from a natural right to preserve, protect, and provide for one's offspring. So literally, natural law provides that children are born to parents, not to the state. And the Declaration of Independence affirms that individuals are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, among them life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, which necessarily includes the liberty to raise one's children according to our convictions. So the U.S. Supreme Court has repeatedly held that parental rights are a fundamental liberty interest protected by the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment and also elsewhere. There are a couple of key cases along that line. Troxell v. Granville is one of those that was in the year 2000, reaffirmed that the fundamental right of parents is to make decisions concerning the care, custody, and control of their children, stating that it is perhaps the oldest of the fundamental liberty interests recognized by the court. And so parental rights is a shield against government overreach. The Constitution provides limited enumerated powers to the government, particularly on the federal level, right? Very limited. And family autonomy serves as a barrier against the state's intrusion into private life. So recognizing parental rights as fundamental helps preserve the separation of these spheres of jurisdictions or these institutions that God has ordained that I talk about on my morning program here at AFR all the time. Civil government, family government, church government, right? Those are separations of jurisdiction. So where God, as the ultimate authority, provides the delegated limited powers to each of those institutions, there is some overlap and accountability. So for example, the church government, if you are a family in church membership, which you should be, and the Bible commands that, the church has some authority over your family and your marriage, for example. So the church, unlike the state that we've basically abdicated this responsibility to, it really doesn't matter what a court says about a marriage, right? The standard is irretrievably broken in most states, which basically just means I don't wanna anymore. And that's grounds for divorce in most states in this country. Rarely do you have to provide any other type of evidence beyond just irretrievable breakdown. But the church is very different than that. The church has a biblical obligation to uphold the sanctity of marriage unless there is a biblical qualification that you qualify for a divorce. And yes, the Bible says that God hates divorce. He hates all sin. And when there is a broken marriage, either one or both have sinned irretrievably, right? There is adultery or abuse or abandonment or neglect. I mean, these things that are major, major issues, not just, well, we don't really love each other anymore, or, you know, we just, we've gone our separate ways and we have divergent interests or whatever. And the church should be the moderator of that. And the church should be advising a marriage whether they meet that biblical standard. That should not be given to the state. Now, in 2025, when we get state marriage licenses for tax benefit purposes, theoretically, among other things, the state does have to ultimately have a judicial finding and an adjudication of a divorce decree because there is a license. And that's up to the courts. But the point here is that it really doesn't matter what the court has said when this is up to the church as the institution that God put in authority of marriage. And so if your church says that you qualify for a divorce, then that's what matters. And then, yeah, go to court and get the paperwork processed and all of that that you need in our civil society. But it shouldn't be the court making that determination for the church to begin with, right? And if the church was operating in the capacity in which it was originally ordained by God, we would see a lot more Christians in the family unit submitting to the church's authority in that regard. So is there some overlap between the three spheres? Yes. But parental rights in terms of the delegated authority that God has provided to the parents to raise their children in the way that they should go, as Proverbs says, and then when they're older, they won't depart from it. Parents have necessarily the obligation, the duty, but also the liberty to raise their children how they see fit. Now, is there some overlap? If there is abuse, the state can intervene. Yes. And we have to be very careful to cabin and confine what abuse means for purposes of foreclosing custody, you know, some of those issues, and make sure it is only in a proper context so that it's not like what my former home state of Colorado is trying to do right now, which is to suggest that if parents don't go along with the preferred pronouns of their toddlers, then the state can intervene because that's abusive, right? Now, that is an abuse of the term abuse. So you can see how this becomes very easily a slippery slope into the state overriding the parent saying, no, my kid who is a boy is not going to call himself a girl. That is parental discretion, absolutely. And the state should not be able to intervene and coerce parents to raise their children any differently on that regard. So it's a difficult balance, and this is where policy questions and legal concerns are debated heavily, why we have bright line standards, why when issues like this go in front of the Supreme Court, there are always questions of hypotheticals and how far does this issue reach and where is the bright line standard? And that's good and necessary because we don't want the state to be able to overreach, just like we wouldn't want the church to be able to overreach, but we also don't want parents to be able to not give proper due care to their children in terms of their safety, in terms of their overall health. If you're neglecting to feed your children, for example, that's a pretty obvious violation of a parental responsibility. So all of this to say there is a biblical determination of what is within the authority that God has delegated to each of these three spheres, the church, the family, and the civil government, and then where and when the institution can overlap and basically check the other sphere rightly and legitimately. And this case that is up before the Supreme Court right now, in overriding parental judgment to not be able to opt out of basically showing your kids LGBTQ sexual content, is absolutely an intrusion into the province of parental rights. And this is so important to understand that it's not just from a free exercise view. A lot of the arguments in front of the Supreme Court this week focused on free exercise and the parents sincerely held belief that this is wrong, it's a sin, and there was a ton of discussion around the First Amendment. But where I think it's even deeper than that, that even if the parents don't object on a religious ground, even if it's not, you know, we're atheist parents and we still, you know, don't want our kids exposed to certain content, parents should be able to opt out. And this is why atheist parents, for example, can opt out of sending their kids to a Christian school. That's okay in America. Now, we can, the church can argue the morality of that, and we should seek to evangelize all of that. But we don't ask the state to coerce parents into forcing them to read the Bible every day, for example, right? And this has to go both ways. And so, interestingly, this was an Islamic family and Islamic parents that objected to this content, which I find a little more encouraging to the Supreme Court's ultimate outcome than if this were Christian parents, only because nobody in the civil society realm at the Supreme Court seems to particularly care what Christian parents want. But when it's Islamic parents, they just don't want to offend Islamic parents, which is very sad, but that's just the truth of the matter of our current civil society. But if the argument were flipped the other way, and this was a school district that was publicly funded as public schools, and say that you're in Oklahoma under Ryan Walters, who is the education secretary there, and that's not his exact title, but he's in education in Oklahoma, and he's trying to have the Bible read as a historical book. And of course the left is freaking out over this because, oh, separation of church and state, you know, blah blah blah, and they're suing over that, and they're saying we can't possibly expose children whose parents aren't religious and don't believe in the Bible, we can't possibly expose them to that kind of content. But then you're over here, you know, in another state saying, but it's totally fine if we expose kids to sexual content that is homosexual, because according to them, that's not a religious belief. Absolutely it is. Absolutely it is. Your belief on traditional marriage, what you think about the family, necessarily is a religious worldview, because either you believe rightly that God ordained the family, or you believe wrongly that the family can be redefined by a secular state, which is still a religious view. We need to understand that religion does not just mean the organized religions, and it doesn't just mean Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Buddhism, you know, some of those types of things. Anyone who has a worldview necessarily has a view on what they believe about morality and truth. That is a religion. Atheism is a religion because it is a view of what you believe about God or the lack of existence of God, but it is still a religious view. And so to have this type of case come up in front of the Supreme Court and focus almost entirely on just whether this is a constitutional fundamental right because it's part of free exercise of parents, I think is missing the entire point. And so why I wanted to go back and get to the heart and the foundation of why parental rights are fundamental, why they are pre-political, why they are God-given, is because we cannot, as legal advocates in society, and I see this all the time with even Christian lawyers, that they argue within the text and structure and confines of the Constitution and end up with this kind of convoluted argument that doesn't necessarily win all the time because they're missing the forest for the trees. This is a very straightforward parental rights issue that asks the question, do parents direct their children's education and have a say in what they are exposed to? And the answer unquestionably is yes. And publicly funded institutions in the government doesn't get to override that and not allow for an opt-out simply because Justice Sotomayor doesn't think that mere exposure to homosexual content is bad for kids. That's her view, but that's not another parent's view. And her view that, oh, mere exposure, is that really that harmful? Well, that's a consideration she can have for herself and her family. But for myself and my family, for yourself and your family, we would approach that issue a very different way. And the entire point is that parents get to make that determination. So listen to this portion of the argument, and it's just a couple of minutes long, but this was one of the key, I think, conflicts between where Alito was going with this, and I think is very much going to side with parental rights and the ability to opt out, but where Sotomayor was going in suggesting that somehow, because in her view, mere exposure to this content isn't really that bad, that parents don't have the fundamental constitutionally protected God-given right to say no. And to say, no, I don't want to expose my children, some of whom are being contemplated, are as young as 3 years old. Really as young as, you know, about between 5 and 11 is about what the court was contemplating that the school district, the ages that it would expose these children to. And that has to be a parental decision, not a decision of the state. Why? Because children are given to parents. They are not wards of the state, with parents being the guardian. So listen to this.
We're not going there.
So, Mr. Baxter, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. Let me just finish this.
Sure. Point.
So just answer my question. Is looking at the pictures, is there any affidavit from any parent that merely looking at people getting married, holding hands, none of them are even kissing in any of these books, the most they're doing is holding hands, that mere exposure to that is coercion?
Our parents would object to that. They thought.
All right. Now, so let's move to what I think your objection is. I think your objection is to the student guidance, correct?
Our objections would be even to reading books that violate our clients' religious beliefs. They've been, their faith teaches, for example, they shouldn't be exposed to information about sex during their years of innocence without being accompanied by moral principles. And here we have both books that violate their moral principles and instruction that tells them that, for example, they can pick their pronouns based on the way they feel, not even just for based on their gender, but how they feel from moment to moment.
Mr. Baxter.
Before we move away from the book that Justice Sotomayor was referring to, Uncle Bobby's Wedding, I've read that book as well as a lot of these other books. Do you think it's fair to say that all that is done in Uncle Bobby's Wedding is to expose children to the fact that there are men who marry other men?
No, Your Honor. And this court in Obergefell promised that parents would be able to continue to teach what this court called decent and honorable beliefs, that same-sex marriage is immoral according to their beliefs. And it's a far stretch from that for schools to compel students to attend. Parents are paying taxes. They have to pay at threat of criminal fines or penalties or the expense of private school. And then to have teachers telling them things that are directly contrary to their beliefs.
Yeah, the book has a clear message. And a lot of people think it's a good message, and maybe it is a good message, but it's a message that a lot of people who hold on to traditional religious beliefs don't agree with. I don't think anybody can read that and say, well, this is just telling children that there are occasions when men marry other men. Uncle Bobby gets married to his boyfriend, Jamie, and everybody's happy, and everything is, you know, it portrays this. Everyone accepts this, except for the little girl, Chloe, who has reservations about it. But her mother corrects her. No, you shouldn't have any reservations about this. As I said, it has a clear moral message.
Wait a minute. The reservation is about...
Can I finish, please? Yeah. It has a clear moral message, and it may be a good message. It's just a message that a lot of religious people disagree with.
So this goes on, and clearly Alito is right, and you know, and he's kind of taken the middle of the road, not expressing his own view, just saying this is what some parents think and this is what other parents think. And you see Sotomayor just jumping in going, well, wait a minute, blah, 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 and spouting her own belief that she wants to foist on other parents around the country. Imagine if this were reversed and there was a Christian set of beliefs that Alito was wanting to foist on every parent, she would be so outraged. And so this is where the left is never consistent in their principles. They just want the outcomes they prefer. And so if it's the state telling Christian or Islamic parents, sorry, you've got to expose your five-year-old to homosexual content, then the state overrides. But then when it's the parents that want to chop off their kids' sexual organs, and they want to do all of this hormone therapy and whatever, then doctors and the state, according to the left, shouldn't be able to intervene because, you know, parents know what's best, right? So it's never a matter of the fundamental right to the left. It's never a matter of defining the scope of the natural right and to whom children actually belong, which ultimately, of course, is to the Lord, but to parents in terms of custody and in terms of decision making. And they never want to contemplate natural rights. They never want to contemplate the greater principles. They just want to get to the preferred outcome, even if in two different situations, the principle is completely at odds that they're arguing. They will be 100% inconsistent as long as in every case they get just to the outcome they prefer. So my point in raising all of this is that we need to be very careful not to just go along with kind of this top line talking points of, you know, of course this is a religious exercise thing because we're Christians and, you know, we have the freedom under the First Amendment to decide, you know, the religion of our children. Okay, but it's a far deeper issue than that. And we have to look at and advocate for those deeper issues. And so the key points for a conservative response is that we have to frame this as emphasizing the importance of family as the cornerstone of society, rooted in biblical and, even for those who don't believe in the Bible, traditional and natural definitions of parentage, parenthood, and marriage. We need to understand that redefining parenthood will necessarily undermine the stability and sanctity of family structures. And this is why it's so important to also talk about commoditizing children and why we should legally hold that Christian adoption agencies can preclude homosexual parents or single parents from adopting. That's not the biblical structure for the family. And to intentionally have a child go into a situation that there are two same-sex parents or one single parent, like the issue that I had with Trump's IVF executive order, is that it's not just about more babies. It should be about more families. And family can't be redefined. Now, are there tragedies where a parent dies or even if a divorce happens, hopefully the children are able to still have a relationship with their mother and father, still have both of those influences in their lives. But even when, you know, a death occurs and so you have a single parent, that's not intentionally and specifically wanting a child to grow up in a single parent family. That's just a result of sin, right? So we have to advocate for the sanctity of family structures that are biblical. And when we are eroding marriage as a pillar of society, we have to stress that marriage, defined as between a man and a woman, is the institute designed to support the raising of children and making sure that these decisions are given to parents. And so this type of precedent, even if we get a good outcome here, if the precedent is just on a religious liberty angle, then that may end up being a concern later down the road for fundamental parental rights. And so broadening this whole definition of whom children belong to or even parentage itself could lead and is leading, I think, to complex legal disputes over parental rights and responsibilities. There are social confusion about roles, obligations, and accountability even within families. So then the default is to abdicate that to the state for a judge or a school district to make a determination on the best interests of the children. We have to stress the importance of biblical and traditional values. So a biblical view on family and parenthood in Genesis 2:24 and other biblical principles emphasizing a father and mother structure for raising children. We need to advocate for the preservation of God-ordained roles within families and that the family has the moral responsibility to protect children, whether it's what exposure of content they have and when, how to have those conversations with them, but how to make every decision from what school they attend to what church they attend to how they learn about society, how they learn about truth. Children thrive best in homes with both a mother and a father, and this is shown out by all of the statistics around that, but it's based, of course, on the biblical teaching. And we need to have concern for religious freedom. Obviously, that's a facet of it, but it shouldn't just be the primary method by which families and parentage is protected. That needs to be a more fundamental challenge to some of these state intrusions overriding. So we need to emphasize the need for conservative families and faith groups to educate ourselves on these primary key fundamental rights and defending the traditional family as a cornerstone of a thriving society. So as you're reading the headlines about this case, the takeaway message here is recognizing the utter importance of parentage, parental rights as a pre-political right. It is not a civil right that the government bestows on some parents in some circumstances or can arbitrarily define what they get to opt in or opt out of. This pre-existed America's founding because it is a right that is given by God himself to parents throughout human history. And we have to be very clear about that, even when we are advocating for the correct outcomes that we prefer. We have to advocate for the greater principle to be protected. So that's it for this episode of On Demand. And as always, you can reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net. If you have any topics and guests that you would like to hear from, we always do these once a week, generally drop on Friday. I'm going to be actually on vacation for the next week. So it'll be a week or two before we drop another episode. So you can always go back into our archive then and catch up on episodes that you may have missed at AFR.net. Click that icon for podcasts. You can find On Demand. You can also find the prior episodes of Jenna Ellis in the Morning, the weekday show that you can hear Monday through Friday from 8 to 9 a.m. Eastern. And as always, reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net.